let's feel ourselves in a circle. Feel that circle connecting us. Anyone who wants to share a dream now can do that.
Okay, well, I had a, so Jeffrey here, Jeffrey Chen here. I had a dream on Tuesday. It's rare for me to dream. So I think something we're doing here is alighting something inside. So I usually don't remember my dreams, so this was quite an extensive one. So the day before, I had been watching the Japanese film The Wind Rises, about the man who developed the Zero aircraft, and it has a rather haunting love story inside it. So I think the dream was partly inspired by the film. In the dream, I was visiting a museum. I was on the way back from something else, and I wanted to see this museum, which was dealing with whales. So I went into the museum, and I met a woman there who offered to take me through the museum, which was organized through, it had a pair of glasses, like a heads up glasses, with a recording in short segments that ran with sound. But she took me physically through the museum and sort of guided me and gave me additional information about what I was looking at. I think the dream took place in Australia, and we walked down a long ledge. And then we passed into a unisex toilet or lavatory. She goes into a booth, but I can still see her small feet at the bottom. She's a tiny person. So I think she was inspired partly by the woman in the film. I meet her brother, who is a musician. We end up talking about my life. I work with the whales, and which is a dream work, not my actual work, and immersive experiences. I tell him how much I love my life. I say, I'm sure you do yours. He says, no, not really, but I can see that there is a sparkle there nonetheless. And then I show them my drawings. So that was the dream that I had. I thought it was kind of interesting.
I think I'll go next because I have two snippets of dreams and one little surprising vision while awake. So the one with the whale, I found myself in shallow waters, and all of a sudden there were two, like something in between dolphins and whales. And they were really close to me, and then we slid our bodies along each other. It was really magical. That was one snippet. And the other snippet was just this morning. And there was Neil Young, and he sang, oh, I believe in you. And that's what I woke up with this morning. And the little vision that I had last week, I think, was all of a sudden I saw this field of forget-me-nots. It took me by surprise. Anyway, those are my little things this time.
Okay, I guess I'll go. I have two things, two directions to go in. One was Ryan asked me a question about how my first dream connected to the book. And I said I would say something about that at this meeting. And I guess you're not here, Ryan, right? I guess I'll do it. He maybe could listen to the recording. The first dream I ever remembered having was when I was really, really young. And I said some of this last time, but the more complete connection, I didn't speak about. The feeling of the dream was the main thing that stayed with me. It was a revelation. It was a reconciliation. It was a consolation. It was everything. And there was music. It was arpeggios on what sounded like a harp, going up and down and up and down. And it just magical. And the planet was there on the horizon, this kind of like the one on the cover of my book, with the beauty of the ocean and the earth, but I couldn't see any continents. Just it was like it was, it looked like it was kind of all ocean. Right now I'm getting the feeling of it being in process, in evolving in a way, and yet it came to the earth deliberately. It wasn't an accident. And this was when I was about six or something, so that would have been 1950-ish. And then it was as long as in my 20s somewhere until I felt compelled to paint that dream. And I tried it a couple different ways. I tried more like oil colors, and I just couldn't find the right way to do it. And then it was watercolors, and I knew, oh yeah, it's watercolors because of the way they are dreamlike. They flow and they merge, and they're so tender and translucent, and that was the right way to bring the dream, the planet, into visual space, I guess you'd say. And so I did that, and I was not totally happy with it, but I was happy I had given it a try. And then in 2004, I began to have the dream about Jupiter Ariadne that started the book. And I didn't make any connection at the time, believe it or not, with that dream of the planet and that dream, which started the story off. Because not too long after that, my partner died, and my life was turned inside out, and I had to go through, I have to say, some heaven and some hell before I could come back to the story, the dream, the dreaming, all of that. And then when I did, it helped me so much, and I would have little pieces of dream along the way, writing the book. When I'd get lost, I'd have to wait and wait and wait, and then I'd have a little dream, and then I would know, oh, okay, that's where we go. And so I just kept doing that, literally, and both from dreams and from waking dreaming, you know, like contemplative writing states or something. And then very recently, I did the painting and the on both sides of the book that you see, and And that's kind of the connection story.
Like I've said before, a lot of mine is in terms of daydreaming, in terms of being very open and attentive to a fluid state coming upon me in the course of just ordinary day-to-day life. And since the past 2 weeks, I've had several things that I'm just going to describe that I feel have this openness to fluidity of what's happening in the moment. One, I began house apartment setting my daughter's house. And why that is significant is when I divorced her mother 12 years ago, that changed the dynamic in the relationship as far as being her father and how much contact we had. And it's gotten better, but there's still, it's one of these things I have problems with in the language today that promotes that we're all interconnected and stuff. But in terms of my daughter and taking the opportunity of her trusting me to be with her apartment, it's about contact. How can you have connection if there's no contact? And I was at her house, her apartment, that was a theme that was flowing through me is I have contact with her by her trusting me to be in her apartment and watch over it, but other than that, we don't have a lot of contact that much. And I purposely am not trying to force it. I let her know that I want more contact, and she's got a life and things that go on, but it just, the fluidness is just tapping into my my grief that both my children, part of being a parent is recognizing they grow away from you, and sometimes you don't know if they're going to come back and be interested in your life. And the other one just happened 2 days ago is I go to a coffee shop that I've been going to back to the grind. And this place has been over the years since 2003, like a working daydream dojo, because this place is totally open to diversity and you meet all kinds of people and interact with people. And it really taps into this underneath this being open to the fluidity of the moment. And so 2 days ago I was out in front talking to a friend, and this gentleman came up that was sitting next to us, and he was intrigued with our conversation. We were talking openly about friends and how they get sucked into QAnon and different conspiracies and stuff, and how to walk with friends and family that, you know, you're having a hard time relating to where they're at. And he came up and he was interested, and I looked in his eyes, said, "Are you all right?" Because he had water in his eyes, and he basically said, no, he didn't. He just said he's having a hard time and stood there. And again, the sense of fluidity of paying attention to the energy of the flow of the energy of the moment. And my friend and I finished our conversation, and I seen he was still there, and I sat down across from him because I felt moved to interact with him because of the tears in his eyes. He was probably about 35 and under. Between 30 and 35. And we engage in conversation, and I find out that he's in deep sorrow because he has a 13-year-old son, and he is divorced, but at this point, the son doesn't want to be around him. And he's struggling with that because he didn't grow up with the father, and he's trying to be a good father, and the mother and him aren't together. And he fully admitted, he didn't go into detail, but he's made some mistakes and stuff. And so I spent a lot of time listening and just sharing my experience of being a father from my age. And the gist of the conversation ended with, from my point of view, of just me reinforcing heart to heart, please be kind to yourself. And so that's my daydreaming. Thank you.
Thank you all so far for your stories. Mine comes from, I believe it was just yesterday. Time for me right now is speeding up and slowing down and all, going in all different directions. I just returned to work once again after working from home for so long. So I returned to my office, which is a private space for me. Here in the house, we have six individuals running around at all times. And my office is a good place to quiet down. I was the only one in the office, so aside from a few emails and whatnot, I was permitted to daydream. I was permitted to have silence. Much appreciated silence. In a way, my office, even though it's four walls, white walls, not much color going on, it's a sacred space for me that I've developed over the 5 or 6 years I've been working there. And I can meditate, daydream, whatnot. But I had a story come to mind. While I often pace back and forth in my in my office, just when I'm deep in thought. And yeah, a story popped in my head. I'm not much of a writer. I don't write short fictions or whatnot, but it was called Elfam and the 10,000 Seedling Kings. And this came about on a walk where I saw concrete taking over part of where an elder tree had grown in a cemetery. So I was thinking also of the abundance of acorns that fall from this tree, and how it was a maple tree, actually, not a oak. So the seedlings are permitted to blow in the wind, and some might land on that concrete spot and not be allowed to grow. But it was just an idea that formed as I was going around in my office of these 10,000 seedlings. Perhaps they're all not really necessary for the survival of this oak. And as the world changes, as concrete forms, many of the seeds are just going to sit there and not be permitted and not be allowed to grow. But there's an element of destiny or chance with in each seedling. They can stay right there with their giant maple tree, or they can blow with the wind and go off and scatter, start a new life. But just this morning, Marco, which I'll address as if Marco is here, so you, Marco, posted that you would not be able to attend today, but some of your words make me reconnect with the retro causality of dreams, where one night's dreaming can be an eternity, or can be perceiving the future or reflecting upon the past and perhaps seeing things that others are seeing in their dreams. But I'll read some of your words, Marco. So you said, yesterday we buried my mother and father's ashes together in the Longmont Mountain View Cemetery. It was a small ceremony conducted in a blaze of midday heat, with the traffic passing at the intersection of Main Street and Mountain View Avenue, way across the large headstone-strewn field. There is a young maple tree near the plot, which will one day offer a shady place to sit, I hope. My brother and I place the wooden art lettering stained boxes into the earth. We tossed in a few clumps of dirt and all the remaining flowers from the funeral. Fate is funny. I doubt that when my mother or father were as young, they had any idea that their memorial remains would end up in a grave in Longmont, Colorado. Through some symbolic transubstantiation, burying the ashes was like planting seeds. And look how far those seeds traveled, how unpredictably surprising life can be and often is. And those words, so often the words I read on Infinite Conversations, the poetics that we form online, it just resonated with what I had been daydreaming the day before. So many elements, the cemetery, the maple tree, seedling scattering. It was just too much to just be by chance there, I think, for me personally. So I appreciate your words, Marco, and thank you all.
I'd just like to say how wonderful all these feel in their connecting, all these dreams and daydreams and inklings. And I felt myself seeing kind of two large movements, I guess. One is the ocean, the whales and dolphins, and the fluidity that Michael was speaking of. And the other is the seedlings that come in the surprising moments. And also the way the ocean is filled with something like seedlings, the little tiny buds of life are just in the, as many as stars, and they all experience that same journey of not knowing whether they'll find a place to thrive or not. Just like all of us life forms do. I just want to really thank all of you for these fluid moments and seedlings.
Yeah, I would like to add thank you, Douglas, for that beautiful reflection and interweaving with Marco's writing. It sure makes it feel how he is part of this circle too, and how we are kind of gives me an internal vibration of connectedness with all of us in this fluid dream space. Just lovely.
I was going to do the same thing, Doug, read Marco, so so I'm really pleased that you did that.
I feel like Marco has read in our circle here today, and it's your turn to begin, Andrea.
Eagle, Eel, Everglade. 4 years earlier. Exhausted, aching with a head cold, Terry was curled up in the alcove with a borrowed scan print, Eagle to Everglade. She'd set herself the painful, delicious task of reading all 26 volumes of the International Wildlife Encyclopedia, published in 1969, before almost anyone knew about the Great Dying. Her volume was open to Eel. Feverish, fascinated, she was drawn into their heroic migration down freshwater streams. They even crossed stretches of dry land to the Sargasso Sea in the mid-Atlantic. Bud, she called down the hallway, you have to hear this. Clinking sounds. She imagined him setting aside his tools, making his way to her. He appeared, crouched on the floor, lay his head against her knee. How now, my love? His Elizabethan tease comically muffled against her sweaty flesh. She ruffed his hair and leaned into the shaft of light to read to him aloud. The mystery of freshwater eels was at least 2,000 years old before it was finally understood that these graceful beasts, like the earliest mammals, were creatures of the dark. They go down to the sea on a late summer evening and never return. Young elvers, orphans, she paused to let him taste, orphans, of the next generation, make their way back a journey of at least 3,000 miles. The final word stopped her, blind. That word always stopped her. But he didn't seem to notice, as though attending only to her. She loved the long off-center line of his nose, cracked and imperfectly set after a fall. Small ears sharply angled, fox ears. His skin as though in permanent shadow and smooth as a woman's, otherworldly. Oberon in Midsummer Night's Dream. She'd seen and read that play so many times, starting as a girl of 13, fled there 1,000 times in her mind. Midsummer was part of her senses now. Bud rubbed his forehead against the bump of her knee as his free hand grasped one of her toes. What's this, an elver? He kissed the pad of each toe, planted a whole row of kisses up to her knee, turned toward her, blinking, shaking his head. Always surprises me.
You, nothing surprises you. She smiled into his eyes, not the eyes he was born with, his manufactured eyes, optical chips coated with iridescent gene tech cells from his own body. A cool, inhuman beauty to them, meant to give him sight, but a wildfire rejection. Too rare to make the stats. Left him with no more than a crude sensitivity to light. The blue of those eyes, not the blue of day, was nearer to black, nocturnal. In those eyes, she was a shard of dark against the light, like anyone and anything else in his world. But he would say of her, contradicting what she imagined, a mystery and a shining, like Ariande. What surprises you? Thinking she knew the answer, she tugged at his hair, pleasing herself with the texture and smell as he came into the halo of her own heat and odor. She had the habit of seeing herself from the point, from his point of view, from inside his darkness. Light surprises me. You surprise me. His fingertips arced toward her face and landed on her chin. And by that gesture, his mouth knew his way to hers precisely. Though often his kisses fell astray, her nose, her neck, her cheek, she almost preferred them. The exploration they led to as his mouth found yet another unexpected route to hers. Lie down with me. Now she was twisting a strand of his hair between her fingers. Let me wash off first. He glanced down as though he could see the hand that left her foot, floated midair, just out of the beam of the light box bolted above their heads. But I don't prefer you washed. His hand smelled pleasingly of something like charcoal, though that was not what it was. She didn't want to know. Reached over to switch off the light. He caught her wrist, said softly, leave it, crawled into the shiny bunk where they faced each other, heads flooded with the intense beam of the reading light. Intrusion for her, subtle, dazzle for him. She tugged at his shirt. He helped her pull it as far as his chin. Both of them let go, they fell apart, laughing. In their tiny windowless bedroom, light stopped abruptly, knife-edged, just past the swell of his right shoulder, harsh as the Terminator line the sun burns while crossing the moon. The rest of his body winding away, a landscape of vibrating grays. She pressed her face into the hollow between his nipples, breathing him in. Cherry bark, charcoal, sweat, loosening under pressure, spreading in all directions. She leaned back to look at him. With his eyelids shut, it seemed to her he was not blind, not until he opened them again. Those eyes that could never see her. This fresh, blinding, stung her.
He was smiling. Definitely.
Mike, you need smiling. To tell your mute to yourself.
Thank you. He was smiling the faint, swooning smile of a man falling into sex. From far inside him, that smile shone on her like the sun's unseeing, unjudging benevolence. Feeling for the hem of her shirt, he swam his hands up and over her bare skin. She woke. In his place beside her lay a scan sheet from Love's Labor's Lost. She read it once, then again out loud, voice raised to let him hear too. And he chuckled from his workbench as she swung high and low through the alternating voices. Thou pretty, because little. Moth. Little pretty, because little. Wherefore apt. Armana. And therefore apt, because quick. Moth. Speak you this in my praise, master? Armana. In thy condign praise. Moth. I will praise an eel with the same praise. Armana. What, that an eel is ingenious? Moth. That an eel is quick. Ariadne, swelling thundercloud, red, roiling. All eyes now encircling the earth, the sun. She startled awake, bud gone again. The faint whir of his magnet brush appeared in the silence, and for some reason, she remembered the year she was 13, before her brother Brendan died. That April and May, she and everybody came to call Shea Virus Spring. She was home from school, faking illness so she could read all day. Her passion there was never enough time for. She devoured everything from Shakespeare's plays, mythologies, archaeology, astronomy, of course, and physics, even a bit of astrology. All her parents' light files, though she begged for the crackle of scratch paper, real paper in her hands, cheap, coarse stuff made from waste husks on which she first learned to draw, to think in motion, to think with her hands. She was allowed onto the top floor of the antiques library at the Multiversity where her parents taught. The refrigerator, those cold, dry, preserving rooms they were called. She bundled up in layers, wore thin thermo gloves to keep the pages spotless, a dry mask to suck up every outpour of moisture and spores and bacteria from her dangerous breath. Precious books and art, even ordinary scan prints, were cared for by trained staff. Cece, her mother, called them acolytes, floating silently in white anti-electrostatic disposable uniforms. She imagined herself one of them, a kind of maiden hermit's romance of service to books. Like ants carrying their precious bundles, Cece had teased. No, mother. Carrying time, our future.
Ariadne. Bud, at his desk screen, spoke the name aloud. From time to time, he was compelled to go over the story he knew too well. For a lot of dreamers, Ariadne, more than mistress of the labyrinth, had replaced Jupiter. But that underground metamorphosis could not migrate into his wall screen or cell. Ariadne. He spoke the name like any other into the listening ear, which told the official tale, not the one they were living. Daughter of the king and queen of Crete, who dared to save Theseus from, Iris crooned. Monstrous love child of the queen mother and a great white bull. Sacred bull, bull of heaven, he corrected silently. Once a year, the king offered the living flesh of men and women in sacrifice to the half-human beast at the center of the maze. Locked in, forbidden to leave until they killed the Minotaur, the monster, which, like truth, was impossible to kill. They tried and failed. They panicked, hopelessly confused, turned in circles, incapable of finding their way out again. The Minotaur had, it was said, devoured them. The year Theseus was chosen to enter, the royal daughter, Ariadne, saw the shining brightness of the hero within him, offered a bundle of luminous yarn fastened to the entrance of the labyrinth so that in total darkness he could make his way safely back to her. Now he remembered there, Ariadne, learning to fit her dream voice to the slow firing neurons of humans. Her words, at first quick chirps, slowed down to honeyed English. Ma would have dreamed Spanish. Every dreamer dreams in their native tongue. When he wasn't paying attention, his simplest thoughts took on Ariadne's liquid cadences. For Terry, it was verbal color that mesmerized compared to their own gray, post-postmodern, triam, acronymed one English. Ariadne's speech in other languages, according to Labis, who knew them well, though unique in exact detail, were every bit as distilled and musical. Dreamers knew somebody who knew somebody else who dreamed illegal or endangered tongues. But it seemed to him that Terry fell too easily, willfully, into the illusion that Ariadne was translating Puck or Lear or Ariel. No, it had to be simultaneous somehow, the way dreams could resonate with Shakespeare, Basho, Oshanga Tahar, Mara Kai. And this weighed strongly in him toward trust. Midnight. Terry, still lost in her battered booklopedia, he made out a dull swarm of dots at the end of the hallway where his bunk, she called the alcove, was tucked away. Elven abode, no bigger than a jet berth. Generous coffin on a bad day. Aiming for the light's warm, he touched cool walls as he moved along, for pleasure now, not because he had to.
Beside her, he wedged himself between the wall and bunk. Terry. If you could ask Ariadne one question, what would it be? Confused, amused, she hid her face behind her book. He went on with the game. I will praise an eel that an eel is ingenious. She replied from behind her pages. What, Armando, more elverish humor? Though an eel is not quick enough, he said, and spread his hand over her pages. What would you ask? She sighed and put down her book. To understand my dream today. What dream? You didn't tell me. You tell me everything? Anyway, it was after. Her voice echoed pleasure. She pulled him down beside her and, when he was settled, told him the dream. At first, it was just a feeling. Time slowing down, gravity releasing somehow. Humans and things, wrist cells, trees, palm trees, insects, rocks, shoes, everything flying, shooting through blackness and stars. The only human I see is a young girl, and in spite of what's happening, she's smiling, not afraid, not at all. This gives me the courage to... Oh, this is hard to explain. To believe in the dream, and at the same time, to know that I'm awake. We all are. And this dreaming light speeds up, explodes. Everything disappears into her, into violet light. Then everything comes back and reverses. She's all red now, all eye, all storm. The sun and the solar system and all of us inside her. I look down and nothing. No ground. We're just sparks winding, coiling around each other. And then it happens. We fuse. Fuse? I woke up and didn't know where I was, when or what I was. All eye, all storm. Terry nodded. I dig the cell palm trees, insects shooting through space. Pretty deadly, though. Without bug suits, he chuckled. What's funny? Bug suits for bugs? Two sizes? Super and normal? Now you're just being silly. Those coiling shapes, they weren't eels, were they? No more eels. Adamant, laughing harder, her breath caught at what she thought next. We were bringing what the others needed, making something together, something that never before existed. She clucked her tongue. Not sure why I said that last thing. It wasn't in the dream. So you do understand the dream then, he teased, laying a finger on her throat. Not dream, dream, not mine. And no, I don't understand it. But I don't take it literally. How do you, he said, take it, I mean. She picked up her book. Literarily, maybe? Ah, he groaned, that an eel is quick.
So I think we stop reading here and maybe have some time to reflect on the text.
Yes.
Yeah. Maia, I love your writing. It is so unusual. It does flow like water, unpredictable and in here and there. It all weaves together, all kinds of levels.
Thank you.
Yeah, the anecdote of the eels, I greatly appreciated the first time around I read it. I read this again, and then now we're reading it once again, or for the first time, but my third time coming across the eels, who before had just been slippery little creatures that didn't plunge the depths like they do in your story or in real life, according to the text. And it's an apt metaphor, an apt kind of formation for Bud and other characters in the story, going blindly into the depths, but there is a quickness to the eel, as is noted at the closing there.
I just want to interject here that it's all true. The eels are miraculous.
So I was thinking about the dreaming versus the dreaming, right? So because when we recount our dreams at the beginning, we're talking about small d dreams. And I've been wondering how one gets to the large d dreams. But in a sense, I guess there is a kind of resonance going on here, where there is a sense of a shared dreaming going on here, which is really quite intriguing and interesting and charming as well. Although maybe it has a dangerous side as well, because I think dreams always have a dangerous side. So, yeah, I was, I think one of the reason why I was dreaming about whales is I'm doing some work in my ongoing life on a project which is aiming to, there are so many echo sounders in use in boats now, which use sound, sonar, to tell the depth of the water, that it's becoming a nuisance for the whales. And the whales are perturbed in their movements through the ocean, and especially coastal waters, because there's so many of these echoing sounds going on. So the Canadian government has launched an initiative to try and replace echo sounders with other technologies that are less invasive for the whales. And the company that my brother has, for which I do some work, successfully bid for this competition, and we're developing a light-based echo sounder instead of the sonar ones. So some of my work in the days has to do with thinking through, so because we're using lasers, there are also potentially difficult problems for whales. So we have to be careful and make sure that what we do is as protective of the whales as the principle of the program, even though we're using lasers. So I spend my days thinking about how to make the light, the laser light, more acceptable or limit its potential dangers for underwater life if one is shining laser light down through the water. So anyway, the point is I spend my days thinking about the whales and how to protect them. So I think that's partly why I was dreaming about whales. But obviously this is part of the larger question of the world that we live in and the need to take care of our environment and the animals and creatures in it. Maybe I'll stop there. I have some more things to say, but I'll stop there.
I would like to speak after Jeffrey briefly, just with some thoughts about other species' thoughts or how they are affected by our progress or movement about the countries and the oceans. And I have the so Jeffrey Drin, you're providing a service, and you and your brother and whoever else is involved providing a service for whales and hopefully benefiting them. But as you know, laser lights might affect them, and who knows what light in general might do to species that thrive in the dark. Whatever we do will affect another species. And something that came up multiple times in this dreaming group that we do in the first couple sessions is my thoughts of how I affect the environment. We noted that with water. I also have a small time garden in our backyard, and I'm practicing Hugel culture, which essentially you take dead trees or fallen trees and dig a hole and allow them to be placed in this hole, and they will compost and provide nutrients for the plants that will be growing on top of this mound, which can be anywhere from a foot high to some, if you have a large enough area and the right tools, you can create a mound that's 6, 7, 8 feet high and grow quite a bit of produce or vegetables or whatever you might be growing. But at the same time I'm doing this, that seems to be beneficial, providing great nutrients for these plants. I'm also taking away a nice habitat for all sorts of microorganisms and birds, snakes that might be living in this log in the forest behind my house. So I'm learning a balancing act between where I, so I originally thought this was 100% beneficial for everyone involved, but as we have conversations here, I'm often trying to figure out where I draw the line while at the same time not overthinking it and just allowing my natural tendencies to occur with nature.
Thank you. Jeffrogen, I was wondering if you could say more about dangers of dreaming.
I was just thinking about that. So we did talk about nightmares one of the previous times. So obviously that is one of the sides of dreaming, which has a more difficult side of it. But I was thinking about the Minotaur, you know, so there's a discussion here about the Minotaur, because obviously Ariadne is the reference to the story of the Minotaur, the Minotaur. And the Minotaur is this horrendous beast. But in a way, the Minotaur names a part of this human self, right? So this is what's so interesting about the Minotaur story, is because one has this beast which has encapsulates a part of what it is to be human. And, you know, so the human self has these dark sides as well as these light sides. So when we dream, you know, and when we dream, we access the dark sides. We bring them to the surface. That's part of the reasons why dreams are so powerful, right? So maybe I'm just saying obvious things, I don't know. But I think the powerful, the darker side of the self is the more powerful side of the self. So paying attention to our darker sides is often the way to access our own power, both for enacting change in the world. So if we just draw on the light stuff, it's hard to find the energy to deal with stuff. But if you access your own power in the dark side, that drives you forward into the world in order to change things that need to be changed. You know, like the way we treat the environment, you know, those kinds of questions. So I think it's really important to be able to get at and contact with those parts of the self. And the dreaming is one way of doing that. Does that help? I don't know.
Yeah, it's really an interesting thing because the dream I remember from this week, which I didn't tell, is a kind of nightmare, and I could feel in myself that I didn't really want to tell it, but now I want to. And it's very short. I was in a house, seems like it was all made of wood, and it was in the forest or woods or something, and had many windows and at least two doors. And I was in there with a lot of people, I'm not sure who. And I looked out the window and I saw what I knew was a poisonous gas coming, floating over the hills, and it was greenish, and I said it was chlorine gas. I said that, and I started running around trying to close the windows, and everyone was just chatting and not paying any attention, and I was closing windows and closing windows and closing doors and trying to get people to notice, and they were just not noticing, and I felt this great fear and helplessness, and that was the dream. And I kind of feel like that is living with us, that dream, in some form or another. We are living in that, as well as the great, you know, beautiful planet coming which is also kind of a blue-green color, both.
Yeah, Jeffrey, I really resonate with where you're describing this issue of danger and power and darkness. I resonate from a place of literally being thrown in that darkness through life situations. And I just ran across an interesting phrase from 13th century scholastic, is that whatever is received is received according to the receiver, whatever is received. And I'm kind of tying this together, that dreams are dangerous because they take us into the unknown parts of us that we hide, that aren't just wounded, hurtful places, but also places of, I don't know how to put it, but power, a sense of power that is honorable, I guess I would say. There's a sort of honorability, and you kind of have to own your ability to hold that power with honor by actually, like Native Americans, you go on a vision quest, you test your mettle, you face into the unknown self that you need to receive. And these gatherings, like this dream work and working with this book from Maya, just validate to me that whatever's happening on the surface of the earth is going to happen. But these groups help me stay in contact with something that's deeper. And actually, I'm going to quote Alan Watts, and I'm paraphrasing, learning to trust the universe, trust our part in it. It seems to be what the dreams are initiating us into, from my point of view.
In my cosmology, I feel that Ariadne kind of represents the Great Mother. And what is so interesting that you describe the thread that she offers Theseus as a luminous thread. And responding to Jeffrey's reflection on the dark side, that if when we go into the dark side without even that small ray of light, we can get lost and be eaten by the subconscious. But if we have even a small ray of light with us, we can explore the darkness and bring back whatever gifts come out of that into the light of life.
And I would agree, and I think it just dovetails that small ray of light is within us, like we were within our own mother, hearing her heartbeat, hearing all the changes she was going through as she was carrying the spark of new life within her body. So the dark and the light, I think, is one of the things, I don't know if this is, dark and the light are not oppositional. We tend to look at them in oppositional context. And I think that's one thing that we have to outgrow from how I've come to make peace with how I was taught that the dark and light are in constant competition and evil and darkness. Not that there's not tension there. I don't want to paint it as too utopia, but it's really just accepting that there's a tension between the dark and light, and that the thread and the luminous is interesting because what's his name? Tristan, I forget his name. He has to pick up or pay attention to that light and what attracts him to it. I'm curious, what attracts him to it? He's in the midst of darkness. What's attracting him to this thread of light? It's that attraction I'm interested in.
When Doug was speaking earlier, I made the connection that I already feel about dreaming with Earth and all the other creatures, the trees, and even when they're dead, because they're kind of not dead. Their life is different and they're nourishing everything. And that dreaming with is not just between humans. It's something else that we need to learn, we humans, how to do if we want to actually go on living here in this beautiful place. And then inside of do, there's this quote I wanted to read. Not all our voices are human. Inside us, we have dark and light. We have all the voices of all the beings. We have everything. And that includes the monster. And the monster came from a woman who was a queen who fell in love with the bowl of heaven and they mated, which was a total forbidden thing. And the child she bore was the Minotaur.
Just remember that I recently heard that only 45% or something like that of our, I don't know whether our cells or our genes, I don't remember exactly, but only 45% of us is human. Yeah. And the rest is all the other life.
Yep.
Very true. Very true.
Well, I sent to Andrea yesterday. I was reading an article in New Scientist about consciousness and animal consciousness. So it turns out that, and I've known this for some time, that in modern science, we no longer think of human consciousness as necessarily the pinnacle of consciousness, because there are different kinds of consciousness. Humans do some kinds of consciousness well, but other animals do other kinds of consciousness better than humans. There's sort of these different ways of thinking about consciousness, and it's not all the same thing. So there's this slowly emerging this idea that there are different kinds of consciousness. Now, so the example is like the octopus, which has consciousness or some form of consciousness in each of the tentacles that operate almost independently of the other tentacles. And so it's not all centralized into a brain, but it's partially distributed through the body of the octopus. They don't seem to have self-awareness in quite the way that we humans do, but they have very, very high levels of perception of the environment through these tentacle beings. And so there's the kind of understanding of it is that in a way it's like there are six or what is it, eight tentacles. There are eight different selves inside the octopus, and they have to work together to understand the world. So there's not a same sense of unity to it all that we have. And anyway, it's a really interesting thing. So I think it's worth thinking about the fact that one needs to think about the way animals understand the world as being different and not always of a lower quality than what humans, the way humans understand the world. And I also think, I was thinking about the text that we read this morning, because there's also an emphasis on this text of language. So we have these different languages, and the text emphasizes the fact that each dreamer dreams in their own language. And if we're looking for a shared dreaming, there has to be a way for the dreams in different languages to be able to talk to each other. So I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think it's a useful way to think about the issue, and maybe we can make some progress on that.
I think my line of thought around these alternate consciousnesses, ranging from the animal to perhaps even earthly or Gaian, or there's the hive mind of the insects or the bee. I think it was around the time we started reading Aurobindo's Life Divine. And he goes very deep into what it means to be human and the depths of what we are or have been, and the heights of where we're going. But something that came up was with human consciousness, how much we're tied into such metaphors as cycles. We've got the monthly cycles, the daily cycles, the seasons. And often that's a metaphor of life and death and rebirth, whatnot. So I'm wondering so we have the animal consciousnesses, the various human consciousnesses, and what is it that we don't know that we, with the animals, we can at least perceive them here on Earth and make up educated guesses as to what the octopus is thinking, or what the octopi within the octopus, the tentacles, are thinking. But what happens when we get out of our cycles, when we tap into something that's beyond what we can put into metaphor? What about those beings or non-beings that are part of the cosmos, but they're perhaps outside of the cycles, even of the life and death of an entire universe or galaxy or whatever it might be? I don't know. That's something I've been pondering, as how to articulate. So I'm attempting that now. So I appreciate you listening, whether you're willing or not.
I think one of the things I'm picking up is for any of this to happen, the longing we're going, there seems to be a degree of willingness to be open. And in the chapter and in the readings, you see this tension between Terry and how open she is to it versus Bud. And I think that tension at the edge of openness to the unknown and to these different consciousness and stuff is something that participating with this group helps me really give attention to. And I referenced it is, it from my experience, it's always been, am I willing to feel into the tension, the edge of being open or stay closed off? Because part of us wants to be protected from the unknown. There's a good place for protectiveness, but there's also this flip side of how, if we're not careful, it imprisons us from the unknown and the wonders that may lie within the unknown, if that makes sense.
Completely makes sense. I find myself often in my life being the one who brings in that remembering, that opening to what we don't know. And around everything we know or think we know is this whole universe of what we don't know. And in physics and chemistry, it's always at the edges where different processes or different kinds of chemicals meet, where different movements come together, where the most amazing transformations happen that you cannot predict in any way. It's so much more alive at the edges, and they're all, you know, makes me think that we, in a way, we have to be facing into the unknown all the time in some sense, or we won't be fully alive.
So just the last thing I was going to say it earlier, but I lost it while I was talking. So this issue of the Wood Wide Web, which is a research done by, which is now accepted apparently, that there's the idea that a forest has its own intelligence. So in the article, the research shows that the wood wide web is like a brain, can communicate information throughout the entire forest, that trees recognize their offspring and nurture them, and that lessons learned from past experiences can be transmitted from old trees to young trees. So there's a growing understanding of another kind of consciousness inside a forest.
Yes, I'm really glad you brought that up. I was wanting to myself. I guess because I have a special, I don't know, everything's special, you know, but a lifelong relationship with dirt and plants and the creatures we usually don't think about. And that whole world, which can be, you know, a square foot or a square mile, or that we call woods or forest, or the world before it's been the word invaded is coming into my mind, by cement and squares and roads and machines, and that world, which is as a whole, it seems to me, unbelievably intelligent and has given us our lives and is giving our lives to us every moment, every breath.
Makes me think of Joni Mitchell's song, Big Taxi, Big Yellow Taxi, or Taxi, where that whole poem or song was written, in the 60s? And it was about exactly what you're talking about, about how the, you know, we're going to destroy a piece of land for a parking lot. Let's get real. Concrete puts us a distance from Mother Earth.
So my favorite place to walk is in the woods. And ever since I learned about this interconnectedness of the forest, I feel like I'm walking into a being. And then if I'm quiet enough, more often when I'm alone in the forest, to feel my being inside of that being, kind of all connected. It's quite I don't know what the word is, delightful. Amazing to step out of the little consciousness that I am normally in, you know, in the midst of life and doing and stuff, to really connect more deeply and also sensuously, you know, with my body cells. And I feel something like that is happening here between us. This is just, this is very special. I'm very grateful.
Thank you for that. That was very beautifully expressed. Thank you.
Like last time and the time before, I feel like there's a whole lifetime of things happening here, and somehow, and I just appreciate so much every one of you and everything we're doing, and that we're doing it together, and whatever it is. And Doug, you gave a name, or it seemed like you were, to our group. Vibrant. And I always like to have names for groups. I'm not sure why, but so that's what I'm thinking right now, that we are individually labyrinths of life, and our humanity and our planet and the cosmos and every scale. And so what I was thinking about for next time was, of course, anyone can always bring a dream if they have one, but another possibility is to bring a short quote or something from something that you, from another person or something you encountered or thought of or read, and just bring it as you would a dream and let it resonate with everyone.
I think that sounds delightful. I do want to read a few more of Marco's words, which is on the thread, just simply because it explains the origins of the labyrinth group, which was by no means my idea. It just happened to be sitting in front of my eyes as the group name that Marco placed out there. So here's what he wrote. I have something Brian George wrote, or my paraphrase of it, emblazoned on my mind, that the shortest distance between two points is often a labyrinth. When I first read that, I thought, I can relate. Also, the name brings to mind my first Borges collection, Labyrinths. I delight in gardens with forking paths, which merge back together eventually in some way finding beyond the mind, yet not without the intellect. So that's partly where the origins, obviously it's within your book as well. So it's very fitting. I'll let Marco's words be my closing words as well. It's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you. Anyone else have last words before we...
Yes, well, I'm just reading, so starting off the quotation, I'm just reading the definition of labyrinth. And it says the double edge, it's connected to the labyrinth or double-edged axe, so, symbol of royal power, because it's related, the word is related to the Minoan palace. So the Minotaur story, it means the palace of the double axe. So the double axe, of course, is the dark light as well. So it's not necessary. Originally, it wasn't necessary. It wasn't only this idea of a maze, but also this idea of the double axe.
Yes, and it's very connected to the goddess and the moon.
And apparently to the inner ear, because of course there's a part of the inner ear that's also called a related name. I can't remember what it's called specifically.
But, true. Yes, the cochlear something. Yes.
Yeah, I was just in front of, I have a tanka in my house, and I was just yesterday standing in front of it and really studying all the details. And so there's a, it's clearly Shiva. And so it's in the Yap Yang, where the female is in embrace with the male, or the male is embracing the female. And she, her arm goes up and she has a labyrinth in her hand. So I just saw the image of this black labyrinth in, and both of them are absolutely fierce. You know, they're dancing in the dark, right? That's there. That's where they are.
I actually came in contact with the labyrinth through my father, who had a ring that is the Southwest Indians also have what they say is a labyrinth, very shamanistic. But I'm intrigued with the idea of how this this artifact is cross-cultural. So my main contact first was with the Southwestern Indians with the labyrinth, and then spread into what, you know, the Greeks and stuff. But I would like to know if, does anybody know if there's differences of how they treat that artifact?
Are you talking about the labyrinth or the labyrinth? We've been talking about two different.
Maybe I'm not sure of the difference. I haven't recognized the difference.
I thought you meant the labyrinth, which is what Marco said was the shortest distance between two points is a labyrinth.
Oh, okay. And, okay.
Which is that maze. That okay. branching maze between one thing and another. And
okay.
So I think it's true that Tibetans and many native cultures all over and old cultures have the labyrinth as a symbol.
Okay.
Of that.
Well, since you were talking about an object, I thought you were talking about the labris, which is an object, the double-edged, axe.
Hmm. Interesting. I'm learning more every day. I just, for myself, since I've been here where I live, they have a walking labyrinth, I guess I'm saying, a walking labyrinth that's placed on the ground and just not too far from where I am. And all I know is that in my experience, every time I've walked it, the difference of what I take in and what I bring out is very significant, and it's probably the most trustworthy form of practice and meditation I have.
Wonderful. Well, we could talk forever. It seems we could do that, but on the other hand, we can't. So, I want to give deep thanks to each of you and to the circle and the labyrinth that we are.
It's been wonderful.
Yes, yeah. Thank you. Thank you, one and all. And thank you for this, Maia.
Yes, Maia, quite a gift of consciousness you are giving to us.
It's mutual, believe me.
Yes.
Okay, we'll meet in 2 weeks, is that right?
Yep.
Yeah.
That is going to be the 24th, right?
Yes, and Marco should be with us then, so.
Marco said what?
He should be with us then, so.
Oh, great, how wonderful. Okay, until then, my friends.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.